Blog Talk Radio.
Hello there. My name is Mudtoe, and this is my little corner of the internet known as the Midnight Garden. So please join me here in between the cucumbers and the durians, and we will speak of things great and small. My mission as an uncommon shaman, as I've been dubbed by a friend of mine, is to speak my heart and hope that there is, first of all, hope that I'm aligned with the intentions of spirit, and second, that someone out there needs to hear one or more of these words, and that they reach that person. Otherwise, it kind of just sounds like me rambling. But either way, we'll use this time to the best advantage, I think, best advantage possible. I'm feeling sharp today. I'm feeling good. So let's see what I can do. I've been thinking about when I first moved to my great city in the Midwest, which has been 10 years ago now. With great hopes and aspirations, I had just entered a PhD program at my great university in the Midwest, which is housed in my great city in the Midwest. It's the same university where I did my undergraduate work some 25 years before that. So I was there very early during my stay. It started 10 years ago. And I was having dinner at a wing place, and I was thinking about, you know, this wing place used to be a different place. It was a much smaller version of the wing place. It was a national chain, BW3s. They were they had one. It just started out when I was there as an undergrad. When I was there, 18, just coming out of high school, a wing place, BW3, had just started out, and they were in a tiny little store, you know, a few blocks away, but now they had a big, huge store on the corner, the main corner, which corner? Let me try and do the directions in my head. The northeast corner of campus. So sitting right there, and sitting there enjoying my wings and looking out the window, and I could see my old dorm out the window, and I could see, if I looked closely, my eyes still were pretty good then, and I could see, you know, young people moving into the building. Could see through the windows that people were moving in, bringing stuff, putting stuff up in the window and stuff like that. And it took me back 25 years earlier when I was doing that, and forming friendships with this group of 40 some people that I shared the 8th floor with, and those friendships probably closer and better. I don't know how you exactly measure the quality, but I think more strongly about those friendships than I do with any of the friendships I formed in high school. Was very close, was close to all, everyone, very close to some. And it was a, you know, 2-year experience there in that dorm, and then we all moved off to, you know, apartments off campus. But we went and played softball together and all that stuff. Pretty much stayed together through that whole 4-year experience. I'm thinking in particular tonight about a young man I knew at that time, and we called him Cicada. We called him that because he had very large eyes, and it was very much like the, you know, the cicada, the 17-year locust. He comes back every 17 years, and they're prehistoric-looking bugs with big red eyes, and we called him Cicada because he had these big eyes. And he seemed to be okay with it. I mean, he said he was from Cincinnati, and there are some places down there where you could get cicada pizzas in season. Didn't really care to try that, but anyway, I remember him for two things mainly. One of them was that he uttered the only authentic Freudian slip I have ever heard in my life. I asked him, he had come back, he'd been out of town for the weekend, and I asked him where he was, and he said he had been out of town for his brother's funeral. Now, he meant wedding. He had been out of town for his brother's wedding, but he said funeral, which, you know, gives you some sort of clue to how he felt about weddings, or maybe just this particular wedding. But in any case, you know, I heard all my life about Freudian slips, but that's the first and only time, you know, so far I'd ever actually heard one. The other thing I remembered was he had a summer internship at a place called CompuServe. And what they did was they sent computer programs and computer content to companies, not to private citizens at that time, but to companies who paid a fee for them. And they would get, like, over their telephone lines, they would get they get word processing, and they get, I don't know if we had spreadsheets yet back then, but you'd get, you know, computer stuff that they could bring in from big computers, and they'd send them over the telephone line to the little computers, and they could use them for a fee and have the same access to the same kind of computing that huge companies had. And while I found this to be a rather interesting idea, I wasn't sure that I would ever want to do it, because it seemed to me that any kind of line like that, any kind of electrical-based line, could be tapped into. So first of all, you could also be providing this service for your neighbors, because they could be tapping into your wire. And also, they might be able to look at what you were doing and see what you were doing. And so I didn't think, you know, this wasn't something I felt like I would want to do. And it seemed like it was just a small cadre of companies who were doing this. It just didn't seem like that was something that was going to catch on. And I had already made that mistake earlier. Of course, I didn't know it was a mistake yet. When I came to school, there was, of course, the computers, not so much internet. Internet didn't come along for a while, but, you know, home computers had just started to emerge. We had IBM PCs in the basement of our dorm, but so this was happening, and they were looking for people. You know, they had started up they'd already had a computer science, you know, major at the university, but they had started up stuff, you know, specific to microcomputing, and were looking for people to do it. And you know, I was in a position to go ahead and start that. But my thought process was, you know, it's going to take me 4 years to get done with it. And by the time I'm done, probably all the jobs will be gone, because this, you know, computer fad will be, you know, sort of, by that time, everybody who wants a computer will have one, and it'll all be, you know, this will have cooled off, and I will have, you know, end up putting myself in a very competitive position, you know, within a company with decline. What's this about? Keep getting an increasing share of a shrinking market. You know, it's the surest way to go broke and all that stuff. So I went into ceramics, which, you know, I thought was going to be the growth industry, and in many ways it was. But certainly microcomputing has had a more lasting impact on the world and on people in general than anything I learned putting together heat-resistant materials for making steel. Not that that wasn't important. It was very important. And I learned a lot, and I met a lot of great people doing that, traveled around, went to a lot of places, had a lot of responsibility, learned how to get along with all kinds of people, how to learn from all kinds of people, how to teach all kinds of people. Experience was invaluable. And maybe better for me than anything else I might have done. But, you know, it does still sticks in my mind that, you know, Bruno's probably out there working for, that is his name. I couldn't remember his name before. That cicada's name was Bruno. He could be an Apple billionaire right now, or a Microsoft billionaire right now. Or maybe not. Maybe he's just a workaday guy. Or, you know, maybe he gave up the whole computer thing and is driving a taxi somewhere. I don't know. But see, here's the thing. Here's what this sort of led me to. Is these are people who were very, very important in my life. And again, I hardly ever think of my high school classmates this way. But I think about the people I went to college with. These are people who are very, very important in my life. I was sitting here thinking about it. I thought there was, even after we broke up and we were all in our separate places, we'd still go around. And my friend Mike, who was one of Bruno's roommates, had a computer, which was kind of rare. None of us, I think he was the only one of us who had his own computer. So I think Spooge might have had one too. But anyway, because he had Karateka on his. But that's a different story. We'd go to his apartment, and he had this baseball game on his computer, and we would play his game. It would have all the major league players and their statistics and all that were recorded on this computer, and we'd go, you know, pick our players and play games and whatnot. But see, the thing was, there wasn't any graphics. What happened was you just punch in what you wanted to do, and the computer would just tell you in words what had happened. You know, Smith struck out. Jones flies out to left. You know, that would just, it would just tell you in words, and then keep track of the score. And that's, you know, that's what we had. There was a little amber screen, probably 4 inches across, and you ran the computer, you ran the program off of a disk. And if there was any records to be kept, a floppy disk. If there were any records to be kept, you put a blank floppy disk in the B drive, and you ran the program off of the A drive. And that was a very similar computer to what I did my first work on when I had my first job. And I became our company's computer expert because I had seen a computer before. And they gave me this, the brand name was K-Pro, and it was two floppy drives, and program disk in A drive, data disk in B drive. And I did all of our material safety data sheets on that, and I did all of our compounding on that, you know, how much material do we need, how much material is supposed to go in each mix and whatnot. And it was a tool we had, and we did it, and I was very proud to do that. But the point I'd started to make before I wandered off of it was that those people in college, were fundamental to the very beginning of that process, to launching me off into that world where where in high school I had absolutely no confidence that I was capable of doing anything. And then after 4 years with these people that I lived with, and we helped each other, and we learned from each other, and it was a group of about 40 people who were, you know, bonded, you know, more or less. I was closer to some than to others. They were almost as if they were standing behind me as I was taking those first steps into the real world. And the way it happens, I think the way it always happens, is that those people slowly fade away, and you're left on your own. And I'm connected now with two of those people, and one of them I never interact with. It's both on social media. Is one I interact with from time to time. And he's the last one that I saw. I saw him back in 1995 when I moved to, he was living in the southern part of the state, which is his sort of home territory. And I got a new job there and moved into that area, and was waiting for my wife to come and join me. And we went and saw a baseball game. And that's, you know, we watched it, and the years melted away, you know. It was like almost as if we had, you know, we were going back to thermodynamics class, you know, the next day. And we parted, and he said, well, shook hands, we'll keep in touch, and, you know, that's the last time I've seen him. So that conviviality, if that's a word, I find, you know, that the conviviality is gone, and I miss it. And it was just sort of the first element of all the things in that first part of my life, that have faded into the distance. Last week I had my 53rd birthday, and that puts me about 2/3 of the way home, if you believe the averages. So 2/3 down, 1/3 to go. And if I look at that first 2/3, and there are lots of things in there that I'm proud of, and some that I'm not, but there are accomplishments, things I did that I never thought I'd be able to do. Again, great people I met, great books I read, stepping out in a way I would never have thought possible. And then that started to fade. And you know, if you plotted it on a graph, you know, over the last 10 years, I came to our great city, as I said, to pursue an advanced degree. That didn't go too terribly well. I'll go again. I met some great people, read some great books, did some great stuff. I went to Haiti with a bunch of university professors to work with school students and school teachers down there, and I got to get up and, you know, give my own presentation to these young Haitian kids. And I was working on some material that actually my advisor had been working on, had given me to try out as a means. He was looking at ways of getting of having kids step into fictional characters they read in books or from other source material, and to see how this would work with a bunch of kids who have never they had never been read to or had an opportunity to read anything in their own language. Because most of the people in Haiti speak Haitian Creole, but the official language of the country is French, and all of the teaching is done in French. And so the kids are sitting in school being taught in a language that, you know, they don't hear at home. We read them a book that one of the professors had written specifically for them in Haitian Creole, and then I asked them, the students, to engage in that by choosing their favorite character and, you know, showing me what they would do in a certain situation. And he danced, and got the other kids up and dancing. This is something unheard of in that kind of a school. It's very regimented, but you know, they let us have our way because, you know, we brought them supplies. You get, like, I think at that time you could put like 75 pounds of luggage. And what we didn't, our the supervisor, the person leading the trip, encouraged us to pack as little, you know, clothing as we could get away with, so we could use the rest of the weight to take school supplies down with us. And we ended up having to take about 20 pounds out so we could get the luggage on the plane. But I've had that experience, and that experience was on the sort of the waning side of this. But it's waned a lot. It's waned an awful lot, particularly since, you know, my grant ran out and I haven't been able to work on that. I wasn't able to finish the PhD, lost my job, 4.5 years of doing, you know, day work and very little else. I feel, what I was going to say was I feel that I've lost my way. That's probably not accurate. I feel that my way has lost me. That whatever it was that, you know, whatever that thing was that I was supposed to do, I've lost touch with it. Or the other possibility is that whatever I was supposed to do is actually done. Whatever I was supposed to do with that first two-thirds is completed, and now I'm at the threshold of something else. Now, here's the problem with that idea, which is a fine idea. I like it a lot. That would be just fine with me. But I'm, as I say, 4.5 years basically unemployed, underemployed in any case. I'm going back to work I'm going on to sign the paperwork on Monday. I don't know when they're going to have me start. But I'm going to work in retail, which I haven't done since I was 18 years old. And I'm not, you know, I'm really trying to feel good about this. It's not that, you know, that I look down upon retail, or, you know, maybe I do. I don't know. I'd like to think that I don't. I remember going to, this has been a couple years ago, I went to an electronics store to return something, and I ran into someone else who had been at, I'd been in the PhD program with, and evidently neither of us, well, I knew I wasn't still there, evidently neither of us was still there, and I remember the horror in his eyes when he saw me, recognized me, you know, and knew, you know, I had seen him there. You know, I don't want that to be me. You know, and I think, I mean, I think it's what it is. I think I know what it is. I've thought about it sometimes if I got a job. I never seriously considered food service, by the way. But if I got a job, say on campus at the bookstore or something, and then one of my professors were to walk in, how horrified I would be, or one of my former colleagues had walked in. Then, on the other hand, as I said, I said about that one gentleman working at the electronics store. I know a number of gentlemen, or a number of people who have finished their PhDs, who are now working, who are now servers in restaurants. It's not the automatic ticket to glory that it once was, or at least that I had thought it was. And in many ways, it was not what I thought it was going to be. I thought there was going to be a lot more exploration and a lot more room for sort of writing the program you wanted to do. But in fact, two-thirds of the classroom hours were required courses, things that you had to take. I mean, these are all things they're working on, so that downward tail that I was talking about, that going from, I don't know if I can do anything, to, hey, I can do some things, to, hey, I can do a lot of things, to, hey, I've had I'm having some amazing experiences, to, okay, now a PhD program, I'm really going to push myself, to having it not happen, to having an apartment with HUD and doing day work, and now 53 years old, and I'm starting off in a career in retail. Now, I guess what concerns me is this, a deflection point for the tail of that experience? Now it's going to start going back up, or at least go in a different direction? Or is this the tail just continuing to go downward into infinity? I'm seriously searching for purpose in this. And that's been very much at the top of my agenda this week, because I didn't know. I interviewed for this job, and I had to put in a what is it you call it, when they check you out. Well, anyway, I had to sign a consent so this company could find out all about me and send the data to this company I'm going to work for. And I'll wait a week. I'm waiting for that, to come through. And thinking, what am I going to do if it doesn't? And my mother asking me questions like, "What are you going to do if it doesn't? It doesn't work if you're not going to work." And I think back over all the thing. I think over the college degree and the master's degree, and how hard I worked for those things, and how highly regarded I was, through that past lifetime, at least people told me I was, and how that all just went away. And is it sin of pride? Did that stuff all go away because I was too proud of it? That I cling to it too much? That I replaced my identity with that, and now that's being wiped away somehow, cleansed somehow. For what purpose? So that, I mean, many would say it's punitive because of the evil, wicked, rotten, bad, nasty things I did during that first two-thirds. That this loss, that I didn't, what's the word I want? you know, that I didn't take care of this, that I didn't, it's like a farming word. I didn't develop it. I didn't appreciate it. I didn't make it so that it would, that it would grow and become more, since I didn't put that effort into it, and that I concentrated more on me and my desires and assuaging my own fears. That the dream was taken away. I remember walking, talking with my cousin JR, who may be listening. He often listens to the show. And I'm sorry, JR, I don't have my computer on, so I can't see if you're listening or not. But we were walking out. We were walking sort of away from where my parents' house is, and there's a housing development, a lot of nice young urban professional type houses out there. And I asked him, because this is a time when things were not going so well for me, and I asked him, now, remind me why I'm not supposed to want those again. Why I'm not supposed to be jealous of that. And he gave me a lot of reasons, which, as I recall, I don't remember specifically what they were, but they were good reasons. And it was a good thing for him to say. I felt better after having brought that up. But, there's always that lingering thing that I should have done better. You know, when my parents are concerned that, the budget they're left with now is not enough to help me anymore. That's why we're really hoping this retail thing came through and I could start picking up, more of that load for myself. Simply because, they're old and they live on a fixed budget and they just can't afford to, bring me along the way that they have been. And so I said, and then I sit with my my daughter and her husband, who are trying to put together the money to buy a house. So they can continue to send my granddaughter to school in the school district where she's going now, and she's doing so well. And, I ought to be in a position to be able to help my granddaughter out more. And these things make me, they activate my self-hatred, that's for sure. And they make it more difficult for me to believe that there's something coming on the other side of this. I mean, how could I possibly have time to make up for all that's lost? But perhaps it's not about making up. I shouldn't assume what's on the other side of this lecture point is has the same structure as what's behind it. And gosh, I feel like I'm coming to a great truth now, and I've just run out of time. And next week I probably won't remember it. But what I'm trying to get to is that I need to start imagining what's on the high side, what's in the last third, and not imposing my own expectations on it, not expecting that this one third is going to make up for what happened in the other two thirds. I think that's it. So thank you for listening. I will be back next week with more stuff and to tell you how things are in retail. Thank you again for joining me here in the garden, and I wish you a pleasant good evening.